Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listnick Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to step away from the world of politics and law you watch me cover on television every day to a world of true passion, which is the world of theater. Although the show we're going to talk about today actually might trigger some interesting political concepts in your mind, because this just goes in so many directions. It is amazing. Let me introduce the members of Turret, and we are both now being surprised by being joined by one of the stars, if not the star of the show, who apparently is on a bus, from what I can understand, Michael Shannon. Well, this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Let me tell our viewers and our listeners what's going on. We're going to talk about the amazing show Turret, which is currently playing at the Chopin Theater, though it is a production of a Red Orchid theater, and it's written by Levi Holloway, who was also going to join us, but he's in a time zone in Europe somewhere. So we are going to talk with, for sure, Lawrence Grimm, who plays Bertie in this show, which is going to run through June 22nd, and then the incredible, legendary Michael Shannon, who I think, because he is in transit somewhere but did not want to miss the interview, is going to perhaps come in and out. Mike, we incredibly respect the fact that you are making this effort. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, no worries.
All right. So, and I see Larry smiling because I think we're both so thrilled that you were able to make this happen. Anyway, so I've got to set this up. Look, I've seen the show, so I would love to talk to you half an hour about all the questions I have about the show, but we have people watching who have not seen it. So I'm going to start with you, Larry, just to, if you would, tell people a little bit about what Turret is about, if in fact you are able to do it, because I have trouble telling people what it's about.
Sure. Yeah. It's not the easiest byline to share, but the basic premise of the play is that we've got two individuals who are in a bunker, a turret, that is a safe haven from the rest of the world, which is suffering from, some have said, dystopian post-apocalyptic situation. But we don't know exactly, beyond that there has been a war that took place, and that one of the survivors who went AWOL is got a resident there by the name of Rabbit. And they take refuge together. And it sometimes is about friends, sometimes a father-son relationship, but they are alone in that space together, doing everything they can to survive and thrive.
And Mike, for you, look, everybody who sees you right now and says, wait, that's the guy from Groundhog Day and Man of Steel and Knives Out. And if we give all your credentials, we won't have time to talk about the show. So let's just assume, yes, you are that Oscar-nominated megastar out there, not to even mention Boardwalk Empire and George and Tammy. But here's the thing. People should understand that, at least the way I see you, Chicago is your theatrical home. I know you've been on Broadway, but Chicago's been your theatrical home.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Red Orchid, my theatrical home.
Yes.
You know? I was there when it opened a long time ago, and just trying to see how long we can keep it going, you know? It's hard to keep a little theater open a long time.
Well, you're in year 31, I think, so I think things are going pretty steady right now, so congratulations on that. What is it about Chicago that keeps pulling you back?
The theater. The Red Orchid. Hey, Red Orchid is what pulls me back. It's my family. Chicago per se, you know, Chicago, I like Chicago all right, but I'm very fond of Red Orchid.
And of course you are one of the founding members, and Larry Grimm, you are also, the associate artistic director, right, at Red Orchid. So can you add on a little bit to what Mike said in terms of your love for Red Orchid? You've been around a very long time with this too.
Yeah, just to clarify.
I'm sorry, that was Travis. That was Travis, not you.
Well, Travis, associate artistic director, and then Kirsten Fitzgerald is our artistic director. It's a lot of ducks to keep in the row. And I get founding member status, but I came into the game probably a year after and tried to run, but Michael and Guy are the true founders and kept me around. And I come back and or it's not that I come back. It's that I don't leave for the same reasons as Michael. It's a pretty special place. And, you know, it, by all standards, we our infrastructure and the way we run the theater shouldn't have maintained us for 31 years. But as Mike said, it's a small theater with big dreams and big goals, and we keep pursuing them. Mike brings lifeblood back to the theater, and we couldn't do it without the support of the ensemble, and then certainly the audiences for the shows that we do that are not your conventional, I think, choices, especially Turret.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, and Mike, when we look at the roles you've had and all that, you said something once at an interview I watched with you. I think it was Vanity Fair. And you made the point of talking about how important it is that the actor be enveloped by the director, by the play, by the plot, and that we don't get caught up with who that actor is. Now, let's be blunt. You know that many people who are going to come to the theater want to see Michael Shannon. That's a big deal. And when they see you, it's a striking moment to see this famous guy that they're so familiar with. But the reality of it is, what do you do? How? Because after a while, I'll be honest, during the show, I forgot you were you. To me, you were the character Green, and I'm into the show, and I don't care what else you've done prior to that. How do you make that happen? And I hope you want that to happen, because that's what happened.
Yes, that's exactly what I want to have happen. That's exactly the point of the whole enterprise. I mean, I am not the main attraction. I ideally, yeah, I disappear and you just watch the show. So it's a tricky thing to do because I got this big goofy head and everybody thinks I have a distinctive walk. So it's hard to disappear, but that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. The story is more important. I mean, that's what you're there to see. Like if I was just there with like a funny hat on and a top coat or something, you know, there wouldn't be any show. I'd just be standing there. So, yeah.
Well, and what Larry is as your co-actor, Travis Knight in the role of Rabbit, who is absolutely amazing. And I know everybody, you all agree with that. But I'm sort of curious, Michael, when you read this script, I know Travis said he had read it like it'd been on his table for a few years because for what he does in the show, he's got to be in good shape, and he is. When did you start reading this script? And what for you, Mike, and I'm going to come back to you in a minute, Larry, but what about this script said, that's the one I want to do at a Red Orchid this season?
Oh, well, you know, Levi wrote this for us. He wrote it with us in mind. It was originally supposed to be part of our 30th anniversary season. But we didn't get around to it. I think COVID kind of slowed things down and whatnot. But it's always very flattering when somebody writes a part for you, you know. And I'd wanted to work with Levi and Travis because they were new to the company, and I hadn't worked with them yet. And I think Levi's writing is very unique to him. He has a very unique voice and a very unique imagination. And I enjoyed the other plays that I had seen, Gray House, Haven Place. And then I loved watching Travis on stage. I saw him, I think, the first time in Small Mouth Sounds. Which we did at Red Orchid. And, yeah, and I just find the relationship in the play so fascinating. And I like the way that Levi uses his imagination to explore elements of his own personal life and kind of, I guess, use it as some form of, I wouldn't say therapy, but... using it to try and understand some difficult things that happen.
And Larry, let me come to you as we look at the characters. Again, it's hard to, I think I never try to give any surprises away I once interviewed the cast of Dear Evan Hansen, and they said, well, please don't say that Connor dies. I'm like, it happens in the first 5 seconds of the play. So I'm not quite sure why that's a surprise. But that being said, I think it's fair enough to say that it appears the world has ended here as we know it. I think we know that from the beginning. But I tried to figure out exactly when this might be taking place. The music would suggest it might be the decade of the 50s. There's other indications that it's some other time, and maybe it's a period of time. Larry, can you give us a sense of over what period of time we might be watching, or is that up for debate?
I think it's up for debate and interpretation, and intentionally ambiguous and beautifully so. It's a timeless piece. You know, you've got technology represented on stage that seems both modern and ancient. You've got music that is obviously from a certain era. And then sort of a premise that I think suggests that it's the future, but there's a lot of indications that it's the past, and memory is one of the things that is played with in the play, and repetition and time. Green, Michael's character has been there for 31 years. I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that I've been living probably an equal amount of time outside the turret before I arrive. And so I think that it gives a gift. You know, the beauty of we've been struggling in some ways with folks have been wanting definitive answers. And one of the beauties of not providing that on behalf of the playwright or the storytelling is that you get so many, the insights that have come around what people think this play means and feels is so much more interesting than Levi laying it all out. And that, I would say that applies also to the time period.
And by the way, when your character shows up, I could argue you're from the caveman days, and I could argue you're from a recent party at the Gatsby Mansion. So people will have to see it to have that explained to them and how that can be, by the way, at the same time.
We call it primal elegance.
Okay. I love it. And Michael, no pun intended, but it's going to come off that way. As we watch the show, there's a sense to which we're watching Groundhog Day. And maybe there's some level of homage that Levi had in there for you in terms of things happening over and over again. But once again, that's something the audience quite doesn't understand for a while, right? We see things and we have to ask the question, unlike the movie Groundhog Day, but why are we seeing the same kind of things happen over and over again? And that, of course, in the end, probably also open for interpretation. Or do you have a definitive explanation?
There's lots of them. There's actually lots of clues in the show if you watch very closely. For example, the first rabbit that you see me interact with is subject 3661. And then that doesn't end well. Then you see another rabbit, but that rabbit is 3662. So if you're paying attention, there's a big screen on the back wall, and it goes from subject 3661 to 3662. Little things like that, you know, little details. It's a show full of details. You really got to pay attention to them.
Although, by the way, your cat Senator doesn't get any numbers to him, and we see more than one of him, too.
Well, fair enough. I don't know. What do you want me to say? I mean, yeah, there's more than one Senator.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I'm an animal guy, so I'm all about Senator. I mean, that. By the way, Larry, is there anything magical? I mean, the name Senator made me think of government and something. I mean, Levi could have named the cat anything he wanted, but he seemed to pick a government name. Is there anything to that, do you think?
In rehearsal, Levi was, we were just talking about cats and the idea that they've got one, they live in two worlds. One is ours and the other, who knows? I think that could apply to politicians. I don't know. I don't know that it was that direct in terms of the naming. For whatever reason, I love the name. I have a cat who might pop up in the background, but I love the name Senator for a cat. There's something more regal about it than for a cat than it is for a representative of of either house. But I can't speak to that. I don't know that Levi writes overtly political work. I think it's probably just a feline, a great name for a cat.
Yeah. Well, he writes a lot of children's work, actually. So you're probably right about that. Hey, Mike, is your character Green a good guy or not?
Oh, I don't believe in good guys and bad guys. I think that's one of the silliest things that human beings do.
So tell me more about that. What do you mean?
He's a person trying to figure something out, like most people.
But
you know, he's like an anthropologist, really. He's kind of like a Joseph Campbell type guy. He's trying to, like he says in the play, he's trying to fix it. He's trying to fix the situation. The situation being that this race of rabbits has wiped out humanity. He's trying to see if he can retrain them not to be aggressive and hostile towards human beings. And maybe in an effort to regenerate civilization. So whether you think that's good or bad, I don't have an opinion about it.
I'll take the judgment out of it. And here's the thing, again, without giving anything away, we learn more about your relationship, Green's relationship with Rabbit, near the end of the play. We learn a little bit more about what that relationship might be. So now as we sort of backpedal in through how Rabbit's been treated throughout the play, I guess that's why I raised the question, because if the relationship is what I think it is to begin with, which I didn't learn until the end of the play, as the play goes on, I'm thinking, okay, maybe you're not a good guy, even though you don't want to characterize things that way for with regard to what happens to Rabbit.
Well, I think really the person that has the most animosity towards Green is Birdie. Birdie seems very angry at Green. I don't know. But it's not Green's fault that Rabbit exists. Green didn't make Rabbit. And Green hasn't killed anybody. Any actual human. He only kills rabbits when he has to. He's in danger of them killing him. I don't know if it's evil or not. I don't really think about that.
I stayed for the talk back with you guys after the show, and that was because I needed to get some information. Here's two things I'll say, and I have nothing critical to say about the show. When the show was over, I didn't understand it. And number two, it was one of the most gripping plays I've ever seen. So I wanted to talk about it with you because I needed to gain a deeper understanding of something that kept me riveted, even though I'm going, what is going on here? But I love that component. Larry, what is the relationship, and I'm not sure how much you can say, between Birdie and Green? Because Green, my mic just says, oh yeah, Birdie has a bigger problem with me. And I had to kind of rethink that, go, oh, I guess maybe that's the case, but that's not the way I felt Birdie when he showed up. What is that relationship? And did you have to workshop it ahead of time to decide what that relationship was?
Well, the show was originally conceived as a two-hander with Michael and Travis. And at a certain point in workshops, I think it was decided that a third entity was needed. I felt really lucky that it was me that got to play it. But I think that's actually addresses the question too, which is, you know, there's not a lot of outside objectivity or perspective on behavior. You know, you're talking about morality around character judgments. But the idea that I dislike Green, as Michael's saying, is true. What I'm fascinated by between the two of them is what I'm fascinated by with all relationships, which is need and the idea that at different points you need different things from different people. And clearly, Birdie is stuck out in the woods and desperate and needs Green in a way that basically relies on survival. Until Green reaches out to Birdie, and he's the one who actually can't, you know, he has a line saying that he can't do this alone. And so, but again, the difference between what you need and what actually happens and what you think's going to happen is a big gap. I'm fascinated by that interchange between the two, and I wish selfishly that I had more stage time as a character, but also to act with Mike, which is a privilege.
Although one of the things we learned about you is, even though you might not be in a large part of the show, you're not out for coffee. You're actually usually, as you said that night, up in the booth watching the action.
Yes. I get to understudy Mike. And then I get to have an opportunity to play the role that Mike's playing for a week when he's goes back for his other commitments, which is really exciting and scary.
Yeah, you're going to step in on June 19th. Happens to be my birthday. I don't know if that's a coincidence.
Oh, happy birthday.
and we'll finish the role, which is only until June 22nd. And so let me ask you again, and there's Mike setting up. Mike, you are just a hero to us today for everything you are going through to make this happen. Thank you for working to make this happen. So you got to turn your mic went off there for a little bit, but I know we'll get you back.
Oh yeah, it was just bad timing. The bus ride took longer than I thought it was going to.
Are you home? We can go in. You want to give us a tour of the house if you're home? I'm kidding.
Well, I'm not home yet. Now I'm just sitting on a street.
Okay. All right. And we're going to let you go in a little bit. I promise.
Okay.
But can I ask you, look, because you've done, I mean, and Larry, you've been in theaters certainly all over and all over the city. Mike, do you have a different reaction? You're on film, you're television, you're Broadway, and then you come home to an intimate theater and you're not in a Red Orchid Theater space on Wells because it can't handle the crowds and maybe the set that is required for this particular show. So you're in the larger, right, but still intimate space of the Chopin. Do you prefer, put all the money aside, do you prefer working in front of this intimate audience as opposed to maybe a Broadway audience or even the television movie work? Are they all different for you?
Well, look, I'm lucky to work, you know, like any actor, you're lucky to have a job, but I love the Chopin Theater. I've been going there for years and I've always wanted to do something there. And, I love this set and the design and, yeah, it's really thrilling. I mean, every job has, something to offer, something interesting. I'm really lucky that I got to do all the camera work I've gotten to do, you know, so that's a big deal. I don't want to poo-poo it, but, yeah, I just feel very lucky to be doing this play, and I'm so grateful that people are coming to see it. And I love working with Larry and Travis so much. And, yeah, I'm just happy.
Yeah. By the way, maybe we can break news. So I know you have to go back to New York, and I know at the end of the show that Larry's going to take over for you on the 19th. Is there a new project you're working on that you can tell us about? Is that what's getting in the way?
Oh, I'm going to Hungary to do a series for Netflix about President Garfield. I'm going to go play President Garfield.
Oh, that'll be fantastic. It doesn't end well for you.
Yeah, it's a limited series. It's four episodes. It's called Death by Lightning, and it's about Garfield and the man who shoots him, Charles Guiteau.
Yeah,
and it's fun.
Check out Sondheim's musical Assassins. It might feed that a little bit for you.
Oh, is Guiteau in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll check that out.
All right. And you know what I think we're going to do? Because you are really busy. I'm going to go ahead and talk with Larry and Michael, again, a hero for making this work. But we're going to
I thought I'd be here sooner. You know, New York traffic things.
I lived it only a few weeks ago. So yeah. I totally get it. But I so greatly respect that you made this heroic effort to join us. I really mean that. That is just amazing. You'll be back in Chicago. You'll continue the run. I'm going to wait for your Garfield Netflix series and everything else that you do, which I'm always watching. Bless you, man. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And Larry and I are going to talk about you now.
All right, cool.
And by the way, last thing I want to say to you is something kind.
Something kind back.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye.
All right, Larry, it's just me and you now. Let's talk about the real star of this show. No, I'm just...
truly. I would love to actually speak just for a moment because it's best that Mike is off now. You know, what Mike doesn't say is that regardless of the medium, and I think people don't know this, how hard folks work and how effortless it looks. And Mike in particular, as just his work ethic, and, you know, in terms of there's all sorts of things going on in this show. I mean, obviously Travis is the one doing a lot of the physical work, but it's just super impressive. Mike has a, he would never admit to it, but he has a photographic memory. He doesn't forget a line. He doesn't forget the lines of other people. And he has an awareness of tech things. He can hear not only a cell phone, but a feather drop in that audience. His senses and his awareness are so keen. It makes sense that he's had the success that he does, because in addition to being a wonderful performer, is a really hard theater worker, actor worker.
And I'm just going to say, you know, what I said to him, I was sincere. I got to tell you, I've interviewed many a notable star on the podcast. And if somebody had been in his situation, sorry, not my fault, I'm stuck on a bus, it would have been can't do it. In fact, I'll be honest with the audience. When you and I started, you went, hey, he's stuck on a bus. We're not going to join him. And we're talking, and boom, he pops up. That is a work ethic that's almost unparalleled today, I think, with among his peers.
He's always that way. It's amazing.
So you step in for him on June 19th in the role of Green.
Yes.
Are we going to see the Lawrence Grimm version of Green, or are you going to say, Mike, let me show you how you do this?
It is a great question. I just taught a class at Red Orchid called Form and Freedom, and it's about what happens when an understudy, one of the aspects of it is about what happens when an understudy goes on for a lead. I've told everyone I've got big shoes to fill, and what Michael and everyone has said is, no, you'll bring your own shoes. And I think what's challenging is that there is a certain rhythm and template and framework that has been set up that you need to honor. But I'm not Mike, and I have a list of like Mikes and only Mikes. Those are things that, you know, just Mike can do
is that a figurative list or a literal list?
No, I have a literal list. I mean, Mike can play piano in a way that I cannot. I'm learning piano. There's a, you know,
and that's relevant. That's relevant in the show.
Absolutely. There's a beautiful song in the show, which Mike continues to improvise on. He's a musician in addition to being an actor and has intuitive understanding of music. I'm learning piano for the first time. And then Mike obviously just has a presence. I mean, I have one too, but the idea of trying to do an imitation, no, sir. The idea of trying to honor what's there, but then make it my own, absolutely.
Well, by the way, I used to play piano bar, so I can give you a couple of how to fake it.
Oh, come on. That's not an easy gig.
No, well, that's a while ago. But anyway, so let me talk a little bit about Red Orchid while we have time. And I need to say a Red Orchid, and I'm going to start with that question. The proper name, and Mike said it, a Red Orchid, and you know a lot of people just call you Red Orchid. How important is that distinction of it's a Red Orchid?
Well, the title comes, the name of the theater company comes from William Burroughs' book, Naked Lunch, which is made into a film. And the first show that we did at the theater was called The Connection, and it was about heroin addiction. Naked Lunch, and Burroughs had his experiences with the same. And there's a reference in the book to shooting up heroin, and it makes sense. It's dark, such a beautiful image, but it comes from a darker place, which is the phrase describes shooting up heroin and how it looked like a red orchid blooming. Mike knows the actual, can quote it, but that's where it came from. It said a red orchid. So the article A, we sometimes leave out, but we think is important based on its history and how we started.
So given what you said, which sounds a bit dark, talk to me a little bit about the mission of a red orchid. Because I'll tell you, after seeing this show, I mean, I was familiar with the Red Orchid Theater, but not like I should be as somebody who covers and lives theater. So I'm getting better about that when it comes to a Red Orchid, big time. But let me also just start by asking you, what there is a mission to the shows you select and the shows you put on.
Yes. Our mission statement is we try to live up to. Every theater company's got one, but ours involves compassion, honesty, and rigor. And in addition to those qualities, there's an old famous statement that I feel like we live up to in terms of the darkness, sometimes more than the lightness, which is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And sometimes we're afflicting, I think, more than comforting. But Turd is a perfect example. I feel, you know, you're talking about morality and goodness and evil and whatnot. I think your empathy for these characters can shift in a second. And the darker elements of thematic work that we do and the characters that are out there. It's around those themes. And it is edge. It is, we take it to the edge and then we pull it back, and the intimacy either in our theater or Chopin is what we're proud of.
By the way, let me ask you a question I asked him, because you're taking over his role. I shouldn't say that. You're taking over the role of Green on June 19th. That's the fair way to put it. Is Green a good guy?
I'm gonna come back to what Michael said.
Oh, you don't get to steal his answer.
Listen, here's the thing. And anybody will say this. Look, if I had to play Hitler tomorrow, I would not say that he was evil, because Hitler never saw himself as evil. When you play a character, if you judge the character objectively, even standing outside of it, you can't play him. That's one of the, I know it seems pesky, but it's one of the first things I teach as well. And if you find yourself saying this is a good person or a bad person, you find that you can't play the role. So I won't quote him exactly, but I will say I think he's good and bad.
I get it. You know, that's a really great explanation. Because you're right. If you've already judged your character, you're judging yourself when you play him, and that taints everything. Would you make the same comment? But yet, as an audience member, I had certain feel. I had a lot of empathy and care for Rabbit. So is that the way Travis is playing it? If you were taking over the role of Rabbit, good luck on the treadmill. If you were taking over the role of Rabbit, by the way, could you do that? But secondly, is that the way I should feel about that character, or might somebody play it differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rabbit's moral compass is subject to the fact that he's not, it's in some ways across his humanity is subject to examination. So his morality is too. I'll say that what Green is doing, and Michael said this in rehearsal, and it was super helpful for me in playing Birdie, that what Green does is pretty, it's pretty, go back to the superlatives, but it's pretty bad. It's pretty treacherous. It's cruel. But it's also, in his defense, his way of surviving. And I think of parents. I'm a parent. We're all parents in the show. Levi is a parent to a newborn. Mike's kids are approaching adolescence. And Travis has a 9-10-year-old. But what we've all realized, I think, as parents, is that we're not perfect, and you do the best with what you have. And we think the same about our own parents, hopefully, that they're doing their best. And I would argue that Green, Rabbit, even Birdie, considering the circumstances, are doing their best.
Well, as I said, it's a stunning show. It's been in my head since I've seen it, and I'm so glad we got to talk. I could talk for another hour about it, but let me tell our audience that Turret by Levi Holloway is playing through Saturday, June 22nd at the Chopin Theater, 1543 West Division. But your tickets would go through a redorchidtheater.org, theater spelled the proper British way, T-R-E, at the end. At least that's the way I'm always depressed when somebody spells it T-E-R. But anyway, a redorchidtheater, T-R-E.org. And I can't wait for the next. Well, there actually is another show going on right now on your Wells Street address, and just getting more familiar with all that you do. Congratulations. It's about time I found and fell in love with the Red Orchid Theater.
Your support, Paul, and your insight means the world. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. And I'll end this interview by saying something kind.
Something kind back.
For people who don't understand it, you need to go see the play. Thank you, Larry. I appreciate your time.
You. Thanks so much.
All right.